I am the Martian ambassador. We come in peace. We come in peace. We come in peace. We come in peace.
You know, that's just like your opinion, man.
Time for Shouts from the Back Row, the official podcast of the-back-row.com. My name is Gil, and I'm your host. And with me, as always, are my co-hosts Robin.
Hello.
And TK.
Hello.
Guys, guess what? This is the penultimate episode of Shouts from the Back Row. After 7 years, we're bringing this podcast project to a close as we shift our focus into other creative projects. And since we're wrapping things up, we've decided that it's high time to cross some stuff off our bucket lists. Those movies and TV shows that everybody recommends, but we just haven't gotten around to. Until now. And man, listing these is almost embarrassing. We've talked about movies and TV shows for years now, but TK had never seen The Godfather, and Robin had never seen Game of Thrones, and I had never seen The Sopranos. I know! But thankfully, we can all stand proud now because this situation has been remedied, and we're going to be discussing these previously glaring omissions in our viewing history right after this. We like to start the show with a discussion of what we've been up to. This is a place for us to talk about movies we've been watching, TV shows we've been following, games we've been playing, and everything else we've been doing. So, TK, what have you been up to?
Other than catching up with the latest episode of Game of Thrones and Rick and Morty, I haven't been doing a whole lot. I am going to toss a book recommendation out, though, as I am wont to do from time to time. I just picked up a book called Reincarnation Blues, which is about a man who is on his 9,995th life, and he is told by the powers that be that he has 5 lives to get his shit together and kind of attain nirvana. And he's also in love with death. And it's a really cute, funny book. I've been laughing at every page for it. It's by an author named Michael Poore, and it is well worth reading. It just dropped. It's available in stores, and I'd recommend picking it up.
Hey, what did you think of the latest Game of Thrones now that you've seen it?
The time dilation was a little off, but
you may recall me like ranting and raving about this one on last episode because I watched the leaked version of it beforehand.
The episode was good. I felt it as a little anticlimactic, to be honest. I felt like we were all building for something. And like, while the end battle was really neat, it just didn't strike me as much. I forgot next week was the last episode for this season, so I know that they had to rush a bunch of stuff to get a whole bunch of people into place for next week. And so, like, I can understand why they made some choices, but like, the Arya and Sansa storyline is really bothering me. There's no reason why those girls should be at each other's throats. So I'm just hoping that that'll pay off in some type of fashion soon, I hope.
Something that, like, honestly, I had issues with almost every aspect of this episode. This episode being episode 6 of season 7. And, like, it's from the big things to the small things. For example, if you have a character who has a flaming sword, don't have him turn his sword on like a lightsaber every time there's a fight.
No, that's so cool. Dondarrion's sword is so cool.
No. Less is more. The first time he lights his sword up on fire, that's awesome. And then he puts it out in the snow, awesome. But then the second time, it's less awesome. And he does it like 4 or 5 times throughout the episode. It really bugged me, man. And that's just like one tiny thing. I don't know. I wish I was more hopeful for the finale, but I have this feeling it's going to be kind of lame.
I'm interested to see like where everyone ends up by the end of the episode next week, so I'll have to cross fingers and see. Do you have anything else to add to Game of Thrones while we're speaking about it? Or
no, that's about it. I mean, I could really go on and on about all these things that bugged me. Like you said, there's a real problem with time dilation where You know, you've got this group of adventurers, and they're north of the wall for what seems like a long amount of time, like days, maybe even weeks. And then one of them just runs back to the wall in what seems like a matter of hours. So, what, were they just like, they went over one hill and that was it? It stuff like that is really irritating as well. I don't know. It feels rushed. As you said, it all feels very rushed. Like they don't have enough episodes left to really do the story justice and wrap it up in a satisfying way. So, hopefully, the finale of this season is okay, but after that episode, I'm left kind of wondering if it's all going to be downhill from here, if it's going to be a really lackluster conclusion to the whole series.
Well, we'll wait and see. We only have a few days left to wait. So, also, I'll talk about the Whirly Dirly Conspiracy, which is the fifth episode of the new season of Rick and Morty.
Fourth, I think.
Fourth. This is, I think, my
Oh, you're
favorite
right,
episode of
fifth.
the season.
Shut.
This is
I'm
my favorite.
wrong.
You are wrong. This is my favorite episode of the season. I thought it was hilarious. I loved how it started with Rick with this sad montage of Jerry, and then Rick just bursting in and dragging him out of his apartment, exclaiming loudly that this was a Rick and Jerry episode. I liked the side plot with Summer and Morty and Beth. And I don't know, there was just a lot of little things in this episode that like made me laugh a lot harder than a lot of the other like a bunch of the other episodes have kind of gotten me. Like this one made me laugh out loud, like often. I like there's a little gag about a helpline workers like in the device that they were trying to help fix, and that I thought was really funny. There's a really dark episode with two kids chasing each other around
I was
in
gonna
a
say the gag
oh
with
that
the
was
two kids
cold.
and the gun is so dark, but just so perfect. Like it's so well set up, and then the punchline is just it's perfect, and it makes you laugh, and then go like, oh no.
Clancy Brown did great voice work in this. There was a lot of good visual gags. One of my favorites. We find out Rick has cybernetic enhancements, and so at one point, like he pulls this like futuristic gun thing out of his arm, and the only thing that shoots out of it is a tiny suction cup on a string to get another gun that he kind of like grasps for a few times. I don't know. This episode just made me laugh a lot, and I had a really good time in watching. I liked Rick unloading on Jerry entirely, and I liked Morty. Morty's getting a little dark, and I'm starting to enjoy it a little more. I know it was just this was a great episode, and I hope that the rest of them for the season are a lot like this.
Yeah, it's funny. I was chatting with Vince Nitro, our composer, the other night, and he hadn't seen the latest episode of Rick and Morty, and he asked me, is it any good? And I was like, nah, it's just terrible. I think the whole show has jumped the shark and is just going downhill, and oh God, it's awful. And he went, really? I was like, no. The thing is, they've maintained such a high standard of quality, and they make it look so easy that it's kind of annoying. Like it's just so they do this bit so well. And they're so clever every episode that I don't know, it's kind of unbelievable. It's kind of uncanny and makes me a little jealous of their creativity. Been
Yeah,
up
they're
to
doing
anything
an
else,
excellent
PK?
job. Sadly, no. What have you guys been doing?
Robin, what have you been up to?
Well, the majority of this week, I've been watching a bunch of Game of Thrones episodes to prepare for this podcast. So that's mostly what I've been up to. But I did get to see a new movie, and that's Logan Lucky, which I enjoyed a great deal. I thought it was tremendous fun. It's great to see Steven Soderbergh back again after like a 4-year retirement. And this is him back on form. And I just kind of love the premise of this movie. It can best be described as Ocean's 11 if it was directed by the Coen brothers and it took place in the South, and instead of robbing a casino, they robbed NASCAR. This is just a fun heist movie with all these really like bizarre, quirky characters where a lot of them really kind of look like dumb hillbillies, but as the movie goes along, you realize that some of them are a lot smarter than they look. And I just love the way that this heist unravels, where there are moments as the heist is going on where it has awkward transitions where you're like, wait a minute, what happened? Did I miss something here? How did they do that? But then as they near the end, they kind of put the pieces together in the jigsaw puzzle and put everything together so you can see like how clever this heist really is. And there are tremendous performances all around. Like this is another knockout comedic performance from Channing Tatum as like a very flawed character, but like a good guy. Like even though he's orchestrating a heist and he's like kind of a guy who's like separated from like his wife and is trying to get enough money to support his child. He's still like a likable person. Like he doesn't have any animosity towards his ex-wife, and he's wants to orchestrate like this elaborate heist where like nobody gets harmed. He wants to ensure it that like even like the people who are going to get robbed are not going to have like any consequences. He wants like everybody who does this to come out okay. But the performances are all great, but the real scene stealer is Daniel Craig, playing pretty much the biggest anti-James Bond character you can find. His character Joe Bang, who's like this elaborate safecracker, but you see Craig with like this southern accent and has just got this weird like deadpan delivery with everything he does. He's tremendous in it, and it's I've never seen Daniel Craig like show off his comedic chops before, but he's really good in this. So I kind of hope he does more comedies because he's really ideal at it. And there are a lot of like hilarious moments of quirky humor. It's kind of appropriate that we're going to be talking about Game of Thrones later on because there's a great gag in this involving Game of Thrones, which shows up in the most unexpected place, but it made the entire theater like laugh out loud when it was happened. So it's handled pretty well. And I also kind of like the whole mystery surrounding this movie about the screenwriter, this woman named Rebecca Blunt, because this is a really, really well-written and well-orchestrated script, but there's question about if the person who wrote it actually exists. There's this whole thing about how no one has actually met this Rebecca Blunt woman. Apparently, Steven Soderbergh is the only person who's physically met her because all the other communication she's done is via email. So a lot of people suspect that this script was written under a pseudonym by Soderbergh herself. But thinking about it, it would not surprise me at all if this was written by the Coen brothers and that they're using a pseudonym of this one woman, because this totally looks like a script they would have written. So I'm kind of anxious to hear the backstory behind this movie, because I'm kind of really intrigued because it is a great script. So it's kind of interesting that the person who wrote it is pretty much like non-existent. Has not been seen in public at all. So it's pretty interesting. So I highly recommend this. It's one of the summer's best movies, though I will say that it is only the be released this year with the word Logan in the title. I still think that the movie Logan was a bit better than this, but otherwise this was pretty awesome.
You know, the Coen brothers have a history of using pseudonyms as well. They edit their movies together under a pseudonym. I can't remember what it is, but this fictional person has been nominated for Academy Awards because of their work, and it's actually just them editing their own movies under a fake name. So it's not inconceivable.
That does make sense, because I actually have the DVD for Blood Simple, and it has this commentary track by a film historian, this like pompous British guy. It starts out like it's legitimate, but then he starts making up these like crazy stories about the film, about how the Coens spent $5 million for the CGI of this fly to land on a guy's face. And you're like, wait a minute, this is 1984. That doesn't sound right. And it turns out the Coens hired an actor to pretend to be a film critic to record this fake commentary tracks, though. And I don't think they've actually done a commentary track on their own before, so this was a hilarious troll job, so it would not surprise me at all if they did this for Logan Lucky.
That's interesting. I hadn't heard that before. That's really interesting. And yeah, it sounds like cool. It's a good film.
Yep, definitely. I know TK will like it, because I know he's a big Daniel Craig fan, and this shows him at his best.
Oh, man. Like, I'm just a big Soderbergh fan, so, like, I've been watching the trailers for this, like, meticulously. Like, Channing Tatum, I don't ever expect anything from him, so he always surprises me, so I'm very excited to see this. And I'm pumped to see Adam Driver do a comedy.
Oh, yeah, he's great in this as well, as a character with, like, there's a whole writing gag how he has an artificial arm that he keeps losing throughout the course of the heist, so it's tremendous. And as far as what else I've been up to, I released a new minisode of The Trail Went Cold this week, and I should also mention that I've also started a new Facebook discussion group for the podcast. If you want to come in there and chat with me about the podcast or the cases that are on there or true crime in general. And I also wanted to mention that I did my first foray into Facebook Live, where I did a live random drawing for a contest we held, where the winner I drew would actually get to record the opening voiceover on a future episode of The Trail Went Cold. And I did it. I was surprised by the amount of people who tuned in, and the reaction for it was so favorable that I'm going to make this a recurring monthly contest. So keep an eye out, because if you ever wanted to say after that the trail went cold in front of the whole world, you might get your opportunity if you win the contest in the future. And that's about all I've been up to.
So as far as what I've been up to, besides Game of Thrones and Rick and Morty, I saw the movie Atomic Blonde, which is the new action spy film starring Charlize Theron and James McAvoy. And you know what? This is a pretty good time. It's got this fun setting. I say fun. I mean, it was a grim time in history, but it's a cool setting for an action spy film, which, of course, 1989, like right before the fall of the Berlin Wall, and it's set in Berlin, the height of the Cold War kind of thing. It was great. James McAvoy plays this agent who's gone kind of rogue, and Charlize Theron is the agent gone to retrieve him, and also this list of all the undercover agents working for MI6. The spy story, this really is like a two-pronged movie. One thread of it is this spy intrigue thriller, and then the other thread of it is the action movie side of it, which is this film is directed by half of the directors of John Wick, so it's got really awesome action choreography. There's one climactic action set piece in particular that is extremely well done, and it's stitched together to look like one long take, but I was reading it's actually 40 different takes, so it's this just really intricate and cool action sequence in the middle of the film. I feel like both halves of this film work in their own right, but it's kind of imbalanced. I feel like it's a little too Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy for the kind of action film it is simultaneously being. There's so many twists and turns and moles and questions of which characters you can trust and who's lying to who. And of course, the whole thing is told in not quite chronological order with a framing narrative from a potentially unreliable narrator. It's all very confusing and hard to keep track of. And it's easy to get distracted by the really big action set piece in the middle and the smaller fight scenes besides that. So it's a really good film. I don't know if the two sides of it mesh, but Charlize Theron is awesome. James McAvoy is great. I want to see more of this kind of stuff. Like, apparently there's talk of doing Atomic Blonde 2. I would watch the heck out of it. I've even heard rumors that they want to try and find a way to cross Atomic Blonde into the John Wick franchise. Sure, you know, I'd watch that too. But in the end, this is sort of my definition of a 3-star movie, like a 3 out of 5, 60%. It's the kind of film where I'm glad I saw it, and if somebody wanted to watch it with me, I wouldn't complain. I'd gladly watch it again, but it's unlikely that I'm going to seek it out myself on my own time to watch it again. Like, maybe if it's on Netflix, I'll watch it, but it didn't like totally blow me away. It was, however, extremely enjoyable. Have either of you guys had a chance to see Atomic Blonde?
No, I haven't yet. I was kind of debating that one where I was kind of lukewarm on it, but I've heard good things about it. So, like you said, it's probably one of those things where it's worth watching, but it's not something you rush out to see.
Yeah, like I certainly don't regret seeing it at all. It was really, really entertaining, and the good stuff is really good. I keep on going on about this one giant action set piece, but it is like a 10-minute long action set piece that all looks like it was all done in one take, and it's really impressive and cool, and like the standout big moment of the film. So it's definitely worth it for that, and I'm pretty sure the spy plot hangs together. So even though it's complicated, I'm pretty sure it all makes sense. There's a lot to say in favor of this film. So I do recommend Atomic Blonde. And like Robin, most of my spare time has been filled with watching The Sopranos, watching the TV series that I said I'd watch for this episode. But I did also have a chance to watch the first two episodes of Marvel's The Defenders on Netflix. And this is the small-scale Netflix Marvel version of The Avengers, where Marvel has been doing seasons of superhero TV shows, Daredevil, Luke Cage, Jessica Jones, and Iron Fist. And now The Defenders is the kind of abridged season, it's only 8 episodes, where all of those heroes team up to fight a grander villain. And I've heard that this series goes downhill. I've heard that it is just not very good, which is sad because I quite liked Daredevil and I really liked Jessica Jones. Luke Cage was pretty good, but Iron Fist was not good. And if the Defenders turns out to be as dull as everybody says it is, it means that we might be seeing this downward trend in these Netflix Marvel series. That said, two episodes in, I'm liking it just fine. I'm getting more Jessica Jones, and she's my favorite character. I like seeing all of these characters on the same show. However, as of two episodes, they haven't all four of them all met up yet. There have been little small encounters where, like, Iron Fist meets Luke Cage, but they haven't actually all four of them become a team yet. So I'm a quarter of the way through this miniseries, and I have yet to see the Defenders. I can see the potential for this to not be so great going forward. And besides that, I mean that's actually all I've been up to. So now let's talk about crossing these movies and TV shows off of our bucket lists. These pieces of media that people like, they're wildly popular, people recommend them. Some of them, like The Godfather, are considered some of the best stuff of all time. It's like the best movie of all time is The Godfather. And I think we all thought this would just be a really interesting opportunity to like get around to crossing something off our list. I don't know, why do you guys think it has taken us all so long to watch these pieces of popular media?
Well, I know sometimes I don't often have this feeling, but I know several people where it's like if something is just hyped up so much and is like universally like described as being like the greatest piece of pop culture ever, it kind of puts you off from watching it. Like for in my particular case, like Game of Thrones, I'm not really a big fantasy fan to begin with. So after hearing like so many years about people raving about how amazing it was just kind of like, there's no way this is going to live up to the hype for me. And but I kind of figured since like they just started the new season for it, and like every time I log into Facebook on Sunday nights now, I just see nonstop posts about the episode of Game of Thrones, and I often have no idea what anybody's talking about. So I figured now is probably a good time to start it because I just kind of feel so out of the loop sometimes whenever a new season starts and that's all anyone is talking about.
A similar sort of thing with me and The Sopranos, because The Sopranos is such a hyped show, and it's amazing. How long now has it been off the air? It's been a long time since it was on the air now.
Actually, 10 years. I think its last episode was 2007.
So 10 years ago, and yet I still see The Sopranos front and center on the ad for like a cable network that's at the bus shelter near my work. It's advertising, see all the greatest shows on our cable network. And it has Game of Thrones and it has The Walking Dead, but also has The Sopranos. And like, it's the biggest one right in the middle. So it's kind of amazing the enduring popularity of this show. And the reason I picked it is not only because it's so popular and I still see it everywhere, but because you guys have talked about it over the course of this entire podcast, all the way going back to when we started recording around 2010. And like, I watched Boardwalk Empire, which was sort of like this successor to the Sopranos throne of being like the big mafia organized crime show on HBO. So I guess it was high time. Clearly, it was high time. TK, why did you choose The Godfather, though, of all the things you haven't seen? You often say that the list of things you haven't seen is long and shameful. Why The Godfather?
Correct. Well, because it's such an iconic film. Like I was able to cut off, like over the tenure of me being in this podcast, I've watched a lot of films I wouldn't normally have, and I've checked a lot of stuff off like the AFI's top 100 film list. I've checked a lot of them off, like a lot more than I thought would be possible, to be perfectly frank with you. And The Godfather was one of the ones that was just up there, and I've just never seen it. I understand references, but just it's just one of those films I never saw, so I thought that I might as well sit down and get through them. And like, just it's part, it's a cultural thing too, right? Like everyone knows. Like, is I'm sure Gil, after watching The Sopranos for as long, for a little bit as you had, there's a ton of Godfather references in them. And I think that if I'd watched it before I went through The Sopranos a couple of years ago, I would have had a better, not a better understanding, but I think it would have added to it. And like, and then that's just a very small example. I feel is that there's so many references to it, just in general pop culture. And now I have the basis for everything, and I think that's good.
And you drawing the comparison between The Godfather and Sopranos brings up a point that I wanted to ask you guys about, which is we have this proliferation of gangster content here. The Godfather trilogy and The Sopranos are, you know, these incredibly popular pieces of media, and they are gangster stories. So do you think that, like, the gangster genre is among the most influential or most popular? Like, what does this say to you? And also, why did it take TK and I so long to get around to gangster stuff? Is it something to do with that subject matter, do you think?
I don't know. That's weird, because I know you guys have seen Goodfellas and you like Boardwalk Empire, so there are obviously a lot of iconic gangster things that you must really like. So, I mean, I admit it, that I'm not a big fantasy guy, so that's why it would probably take me so long to watch Game of Thrones. But it is kind of curious that it would take you guys so long to watch these iconic gangster projects.
Do you have any thoughts on that, TK?
Well, like, I hadn't seen Goodfellas until we started this podcast. Like, there were big gangster, yeah, there were big gangster movies I haven't seen, or like, and to be perfectly frank, there was a lot of like other Scorsese movies I hadn't seen either. So like Goodfellas, I saw Taxi Driver listening to this podcast. That's really awful. What was that other one with De Niro?
Raging Bull, I think, right?
Yeah, Raging Bull. What was that other one with Jerry Lewis that you made us watch, Robin?
King of Comedy.
Yeah, that was like, I haven't seen all these films, so I don't want to say it's like. And I've caught up with Scorsese later, like The Departed and Gangs of New York and stuff like that. But like, it's this whole section of like the 70s and 80s film culture that I think was so big. And it was just part of a genre I never really had a super big interest in until I started to get into it. Like, I think Boardwalk probably kicked it, because I don't think I even had a big interest in watching The Sopranos until I was about halfway through Boardwalk Empire. So I'm sure it upped just the limit on anything. And then you see all these movies come out, like Gangs of New York, or like what was the recent one with Johnny's Whitey Bulger. Like, there's like, this stuff is big. And I think that the stuff that I watch, the stuff that you're watching now, Gil, has a big component of that. And it's something that both of us have been missing. So I think it's cool that we've caught up on a lot of it.
You know what? One of the factors that has kept me from getting into The Sopranos, for one thing, I didn't really like, I hesitate to say this. I just never had the opportunity to watch it with anyone. When it was on, I'm sure a bunch of people I know watched it as it was airing, but I didn't have anybody recommending it to me the way like I had people recommended Breaking Bad to me before I started watching it. And so I tuned in, you know, a few episodes into the first season and just went from there. But nobody had recommended The Sopranos for me when it was on. So I didn't catch it when it was on, and I think the reason it took me so long to get around to it is there are generally two types of gangster content that I like. One is based on a true story stuff, and the other is like period organized crime stories. And The Sopranos is neither of these things. So I think that's why I didn't leap on it right away, and that's why I went more for things like, you know, Boardwalk Empire, for example. So, you know, maybe that's like the main reason. But we'll talk about what I thought of it in a bit. We've been talking about The Godfather. I think that's a great place to start. I mean, what better way to help wrap up Shouts from the Back Row in its entirety by actually having a discussion of what is considered by many to be the greatest film of all time. And, you know, this is the movie that is constantly duking it out with The Shawshank Redemption for the top spot in the Internet Movie Database top 250 movies of all time list, and it's been there forever. I think for as long as that list has existed, The Godfather has been right by the top. And The Godfather Part 2, as of this recording, is in the number 3 spot, But Shawshank Redemption is currently number one, so it's like constantly up there. And TK, you've finally seen all three Godfather movies. So here's the question. Does this movie deserve the crown of best movie ever made?
See, I'm after watching them, I don't know, just from a pure technical standpoint, I'm going to lean way more towards Citizen Kane than I'm going to this. But like I was halfway through watching part two, and I just said out loud to myself, and like, this is kind of ridiculous, I just said, these are really good. Like, and I know that's
no,
right? Like, I don't
whoa,
know.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Let's not have too controversial an opinion on this.
No, I was just, I don't want to say I was surprised, but it was like, I was just kind of struck at how kind of powerful the stories were, and like how, like, it's the rise and fall of a mobster. And like, I've seen stuff like that before, but like not done in this big, intricate, generation spanning way. Marlon Brando was incredible in the first movie. Wow. Pacino was great little less three, but he was really, really like amazingly like subdued in the first two films. I was really, really impressed with it. James Caan was good. But De Niro in the second movie blew me away. Like he was just unbelievable. And I was reading up on it later. Like he got the Best Supporting Actor Oscar for that. And I think he spoke like 95% of his dialogue in Italian, which I thought was super cool, because I don't think that's happened before. And it was just, I don't know, it was just such a powerful story. And I always forgot, I haven't seen a Coppola film in a long time, so I always forgot how very good he was at staging. Not necessarily cinematography, but just how good he was at like putting people in rooms where they were visible, like queuing up like a lot of visual stuff that would pay off later on. Like everybody knows about the oranges in the Godfather series, so they represent death. And like once you know that, it's very easy to pick up on all these points. I think I was watching two, Gil, and I mentioned to you that like, oh my god, there's a Don holding an orange, watch out. Yeah. I don't know, and that sort of stuff was like really neat to pick up on, and like big, long, elaborate shots, and I like the way Coppola put the film together, because I think it made it a little more human, if that made sense. Because I think like a rush story, like looking at the Whitey Bulger film I watched recently with Depp, like that was a very quick story, and like to see this big overarching narrative, it's kind of, you connect with the characters a lot more. It's like you understand why Fredo is the way he is. You understand why Sonny is the way he is. And I think it's after two, you get a much bigger sense of what Vito Corleone was like. And it's just, it's such an interesting family narrative, and how everybody, and how all, like everything has a consequence. Everything pays off in one way or another. And it's such a rich story. And I don't think I've seen such a deep, meaningful story portrayed in such a way on film before. So I think that that's what kind of cemented everything for me. But there's a huge disparity between part two and part three. Like you see Pacino go full Pacino in the third film. Like he's very subdued in the first two, and then he like goes like the full like yelling, and like his body language changes. And I think he got away from the character a little bit. Like I really liked the storylines. I thought it was all fascinating. God, it was good. It's been a neat couple of days watching all these films. Is what I'll get up to. It was super cool. And like I know you guys have seen them, and I think it's funny that like finally I've reached that point. Like you know, it was a long running joke. It's like, oh, we could make TK watch The Godfather next week. Oh, he hasn't seen them. We can't review them. I don't know. I always thought that.
No more.
Fun. No more. I've seen them. I've seen all three of them, and it's. I know. I had a really good time watching this. And cool. especially in the later half of the second and third movie, you really feel the guilt of what Michael's done, like kind of bear up. Diane Keaton was great in the two, and I think she's like what, 22? Like she's not old in this. I kept on saying to myself, like I couldn't believe how young the actors were. Like it's like De Niro was, I don't think De Niro was 30, and I think Pacino had just turned it. Like it was just, I don't know, it was such a neat film. God, Brando was good though. Holy jeez, he was good. these were great movies. Like they were. I'm so glad I finally took the time to watch them, is what it comes down to.
And thank you for giving us seven glorious years of teasing you about not having seen them.
Remember for the first year or so, it was the good, the bad, and the ugly. And then he finally watched that. Now this was the running gag ever since.
Well, what could I say? You guys made me an offer I couldn't refuse.
So Robin, same question to you. Does this deserve the crown of best movie ever made?
I wouldn't object to it. Like, it's hard to really decide the best we ever made, but like this, at least the original and possibly part two, like you see it at the top of the list and you can't really complain, saying that they're pretty much perfect in every way. Like they're pretty much a mastercraft in filmmaking in general. I remember I took a 1 week script writing course at Humber College several years ago. And one of the professors says, I sometimes talk to film students who tell me they've never seen The Godfather. And it's almost like, I feel like I should tell them, just get out of my class. Like you can't say you honestly understand film and storytelling if you've never seen The Godfather, because it's just such perfect in every way. And it took like a mammoth novel that spanned like several decades and had several interlocking storylines and condensed it so well into 3 hours into a movie where it's just real hard to find any flaws with it. And it launched so many careers and created so many iconic moments. Like Brando's performance is pretty much one of the most iconic performances in film history. Like everyone who thinks of Marlon Brando, they don't think of younger Marlon Brando when he was like this, when he gave performances in like Streetcar Named Desire or On the Waterfront. They think of him as the Godfather because he does such an iconic character. And part two is always listed as one of the greatest sequels ever made. Like it was the only sequel to actually win Best Picture. And even though Godfather 3 is pretty flawed and it doesn't measure up to the second films at all, it's still a pretty good movie on its own right, a good standalone movie when you watch it. So it is an ideal completion of the trilogy. And I always found the character of Michael Corleone to just be so fascinating, because he starts off as the one member of the family who wants to be legitimate and wants nothing to do with like his family's criminal business. But as he gets sucked in, he becomes more evil than all of them, and eventually gets to the point where he's like willing to have his own brother assassinated. And just and then of course at the end he pays for his sins by having to watch his own daughter die in front of them and then die alone at the end. So it's such a great character arc for him that you can see, but you still identify him with him though, even though he's such an evil character, because you can see why he became the way he was, and intercutting back and forth showing how his father, even though his father was a criminal, he kind of rose in a more honorable way. So it's interesting to see the parallels between them. It's just such masterful storytelling altogether, and a must see for anyone who's a film buff.
Yeah, you can absolutely see how this movie became so influential, just because, you know, as you were saying, Robin, there's really nothing that you can pick apart too much, especially with The Godfather. I mean, yes, loads of people have issues with The Godfather Part 3 and Sofia Coppola's performance in particular, but certainly The Godfather is just this masterclass in how to make a movie and how to tell a story, and it's really impressive on every level to consider. Like, every scale that is applied to this movie is done so really well. Like you said, you know, it adapts this enormous novel and it manages to condense the idea, like following these characters, especially through parts one and two. You follow these characters through their entire lives and you get to see like all this rich and intricate history and all these different periods of time when organized crime existed. And it's just fascinating to consider it on sort of like a historical scale, to think about the idea of these criminal families. This is one of those movies that really brought that idea into the mainstream, because there had been gangster movies before, but there hadn't really been these gangster movies where you really get inside the head of like a mafia don and see him as a sympathetic character. And while I was watching The Sopranos and I rewatched highlights of the Godfather trilogy to sort of refresh my memory on it, and I was so struck by the appeal of like the mafioso, the appeal of the mob boss, the gangster, you know, the prince of crime kind of character. And it is fascinating for me to consider this idea of these family legacies, multiple generations, where the family business is just crime. It's all different sorts of crime. And these family lines run crime like it's a business, like it's the family store that gets passed from generation to generation, or, you know, the company where the CEO dies and his son takes his place. But in this case, it is criminal activity. It's gambling, it's narcotics, it's murder. It's just so fascinating to consider that aspect of it. And we all love an anti-hero, so it's especially these anti-heroes who are criminals, and not only do they get away with it, but they get to live the high life. They get to, you know, have these opulent mansions and these cars and, you know, these awesome looking suits, just all of these aspects of it. It is undoubtedly appealing to glorify that lifestyle. And when it comes to The Godfather specifically, it's so cool to, I mean, I say cool, but maybe the better word is fascinating, but to study how it has influenced actual organized crime, and, you know, how much The Godfather had an influence on reality and the reality of organized crime. I'm sure it is just constantly referenced. I love that in The Sopranos, you're constantly having characters doing imitations of Al Pacino from The Godfather, and, you know, making more subtle references, like being like, oh, it's a Mo Green situation, you know, and it's a Godfather reference. It is fascinating to see how interwoven into pop culture this film is and how much it influenced reality. And I think that perhaps is the best reason to give it the crown for best movie of all time, is that it's so interwoven with reality that it basically is reality now. You know, these are fictional characters that we're watching in these movies, but they might as well be real, given the legend that has been left in their wake. And that leads me to another question that I have for you guys, which is, has pop culture spoiled this movie? You were saying, TK, you know, oh no, he's holding an orange, look out. That means he's going to die. When I was rewatching highlights of it, you know, there's the famous bit of trivia that Marlon Brando stuffed his cheeks full of cotton balls. So now when I was rewatching clips, I was like, oh yeah, he's totally just got his cheeks full of cotton balls. And in a way, it was a little silly. Has pop culture spoiled this movie, TK, now that you've seen it after this long?
I'm not going to say it's spoiled it, but like, I know the major plot points. Like, I know what's going to happen just based on how the film's been put together and portrayed across the last 20, 30 years, I guess. But it's cool to watch it in sequence. Like, watching a highlight clip, I think, would be kind of dull. But like, the lead up to Vito Corleone, when he's played by De Niro, killing that Don is really neat. Like, the whole sequence, and like, I know there's clips of him just shooting him in the hallway, but it doesn't add to everything. So the whole storyline weaving together makes like those really famous parts really good. Like, I really liked all the lead up to the horse head. That was super cool, because I've seen that scene, like the scene in the bed, a few times, but it was super cool to watch that like grow and come together. I just thought it was cool. So I like, yes and no. Like, points have been spoiled, but the whole thing hasn't been. And I think that was, I got more out of it watching it together as opposed to just bits and pieces.
As a tangent to that horse head scene, Caitlin and I recently saw a rubber mask of a unicorn. And I was joking that I should buy it and then leave it in someone's bed. And she said, yeah, you could be the fairy godfather. leave a unicorn head in someone's bed. Anyway, Robin, has pop culture spoiled The Godfather?
Not really, because I saw it when I was still in high school. I was pretty young, and that was after I had read the novel as part of a class. I actually read the novel first before I saw the movie, and I really didn't know any of the pop culture references at that point. I really didn't know until I read the novel what The Godfather was really about. But, I mean, throughout recent years, there's been so many pop culture things. Like, if you watch The Sopranos, I'm sure TK, now that he watched The Godfather, like you said, he now gets more of the jokes that popped up in The Sopranos from time to time, because they made so many references to it. But at the time I originally saw The Godfather, I really had no context to it, so it wasn't spoiled for me. I only knew like the theme song, and that was pretty much it.
Yeah, you know what, you and I must have seen The Godfather before, like, the internet era, before the internet became what it is today, which I think is probably more responsible for spoiling things like the oranges and, you know, the cotton balls and Brando's cheeks. Because I definitely recall I saw this, I checked out a VHS copy of The Godfather from the local library and watched it. And I want to say, like, I guess it must have been the very early 90s, like maybe just when I had discovered IMDb. And so it was IMDb that gave me that trivia. I was like, oh yeah, watch for oranges in this series, or, you know, the cotton balls, et cetera, et cetera. Luca Brasi couldn't get his lines right, and that's why they have him rehearsing in the movie, etc. So, I don't know. I guess pop culture couldn't have spoiled it for me at that time. But it's interesting to hear TK's perspective on that, because it is so prevalent in pop culture now.
One other thing I wanted to add about reading the book in high school is that I actually think the movie is better than the book, even though the book is great, because it cuts out the stupid subplots. I don't know if you've heard this story, but the book had an entire subplot about how Sonny had a large cock, and the mistress that he's having sex with during the wedding scene at the opening, apparently he had sex with her so many times that his cock damaged her vagina, and there's a whole chapter about how she gets a gynecological repair job and then has an affair with a guy gynecologist, and it's so, like, I'm not making this up, yeah, and it just so doesn't fit with the rest of the story. I mean, it is kind of cool because she has a son, and then the son goes up to be Andy Garcia's character in Godfather 2, but it's not interesting at all. But and then thankfully they cut all this stuff out in the movie except the scene where Sonny's like having sex with his mistress. But I just reading that, it's like, why is this in the novel? It has nothing to do with the family. It's like, who cares about this woman's vagina problems and stuff? So this is one case where the movie is better than the book, where they actually cut out the stuff that wasn't necessary.
Speaking of the book, TK, you're an avid reader. Are you going to read the book? I'm sure that hearing about the subplot involving Sonny's penis really sold you on it.
Oh man, I gotta pick it up now. I don't think I'm gonna read the books, to be honest. I think the film is kind of standing in on its own.
Well, fair enough. So I mean, here's one final loaded question for you. Is this 5 out of 5? Are you giving it the 100%?
Yeah, I think so. Right on. With like an obligatory like star drop for 3. But
okay,
yeah.
So actually maybe not final question. Let's hear your beef with 3. Is it all Sofia Coppola or what?
It's okay, so to be perfectly frank, she's not in the film that much, like over the grand scheme of things. Like I was saying, I really like Andy Garcia. I really like the plot of the whole thing, but like you can tell Pacino has changed. Like I said, in the first two films, he plays it very cool and collected, and now we start seeing like his big like his outbursts. Like we start to see that a lot more, and I think it takes away from the character a lot, because he seems to me like a totally different person.
Interesting. You know what? In my opinion, it's not Pacino that changed; it was Francis Ford Coppola who had changed. He had not been like the. His film output at that time hadn't been great, and he often talks about how Apocalypse Now really like did a number on him to the point where he just didn't feel like he ever quite recovered from it. So I attribute its faults primarily to Coppola just sort of being weary after having made Apocalypse Now, and I believe also his son had died at this point in his life, so it was probably not a very good time for him. And the whole thing with Sofia Coppola, I learned, is that Winona Ryder was cast in that part and then walked off the set the day before they were supposed to start shooting. So Sofia Coppola was like a last-minute replacement. And, you know, a lot of people do cry nepotism at her casting, but I think it's kind of understandable that Francis would just be like, anyone, you, honey, get in there. I know I can rely on you.
Robin, what's funny is I think of Winona... It's funny, what I think of Winona Ryder is, like, I don't think she would have been right for that role either. I can't really picture her as, like, the daughter of an Italian family, so I don't know if that would have worked well either.
At least she was a more accomplished actor at that point, at the very least. One last bit of trivia that I learned when I was researching The Godfather and refreshing my memory on it is, apparently, I don't know if this is true, but I heard that The Godfather Part 2 was the first movie to use Part 2 to indicate a sequel, and that prior to that, they had called sequels by different names, similar to A Fistful of Dollars and For a Few Dollars More, to avoid confusing audiences. Do you know if that's true, Robin?
It is, yes. I think Francis Ford Coppola confirmed that in an interview, and it's kind of funny, the I think there was one other film that came out that year. It was Walking Tall Part 2, but they called it Part 2 Walking Tall for some reason. They put the Part 2 first, but Godfather Part 2 is apparently the very first movie to do that, but after that, it just caught on, because obviously it won Best Picture and was considered the greatest sequel ever made, so that's why the other films followed suit.
Insane. Like, that is genuine film history that you can chart. Because it's still around today. Part 2 is still used. Man, I think that is just unbelievably cool. Any final thoughts on The Godfather before we move on?
Every time I think I was out, they pull me back in.
Yeah. Amazing. Just amazing. All right, now Game of Thrones. This is exciting. Because TK and I have basically been talking about this show every episode since we started this podcast, because it started airing in 2010. Or I guess it was probably early 2011. It was announced in 2010. So we've been talking about this one a long time, and at last, Robin, you have caught up with it. So, first off, how much have you watched?
Well, I wanted to finish the complete first season, but I only made it to 8 episodes, but I do plan to see, like, at least the rest of the season and probably move on to the next one. So I've seen a lot of the big moments in the first season, but I probably am not familiar with everything. But it was kind of a breath of fresh air when you were talking about the recent episode early in the podcast, and it's like, hey, I know which characters you're talking about now. Yay.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, Sansa and Arya are fighting about something. I know this now.
So, yes, that's surprising.
to give us a sense of where you are in the plot, what is, like, the most recent revelation that you've seen on the show?
I think it was the double cross, like, where Ned was going to give, like, the big revelation that Joffrey was not King Robert's son, and then he got arrested for it and double crossed by Littlefinger and pushed into the dungeon, and now they're pretty much starting up the war between the Lannister family and the Stark family.
Awesome. Oh my god, it's wild just, like, thinking back to that time, because it's been so long since I watched that part of the show. So what are your thoughts so far? Can you see why it's popular, and are you enjoying it?
Yes, it is pretty entertaining. Like, one of the reasons I was turned off is I had heard so much about how the series got out of, or George R. Martin, and how he got so out of control with, like, the world building, how, like, there were just so many different subplots and so many different characters, and I've heard all the stories how it's taking forever for him to, like, finish this last novel, and that the series has to go in a different direction because he is taking so long. And at the start, I was just kind of confused because they were establishing all these different characters, all these different families, and it was hard to get into, but then it finally settled down into a groove where you knew the characters and you knew all their motivations, and it started to make sense, and I got really hooked on it. I thought that the pilot episode had a great cliffhanger at the end where the Stark boy, like, spies in on Cersei and Jaime, the brother and sister, having sex, performing incest, and they decide to respond by pushing him off the tower, and, like, the last shot of the final episode is his body falling towards the camera, and you're like, oh shit, there's gonna be big trouble here, and they pretty much built off of it throughout the season, the tension between the two families. But they've done a great job at establishing all the characters, like, they're the ones who try very hard to maintain honor, and the ones who just have no morals whatsoever. And it's kind of great to see this, like, world where, like, pretty much everyone is depraved in their own little way. Like, women are pretty much seen as nothing more than people that people for men to have sex with. It's kind of like they all the like the powerful men have like about a dozen different women that they have sex with all at one time and stuff. But even like the most depraved characters have kind of their sense of honor and stuff, that there's a certain way to do things. And you can kind of see it with the character of King Robert, who how he still wants to maintain his loyalty to the Stark family because he was such close friends with Ned. But you can kind of see how things are going to fall apart. And it's kind of cool to see the evolution of King Joffrey, because I've heard him throughout the last several years how he is one of the most detestable characters in the history of television, and all I've seen at the beginning is him being kind of this bratty kid who shows himself to be in a coward when his life's in danger, and now I'm seeing him finally like ascertain the throne, and you kind of see that the shit is about to get bad once this kid goes into power. And it's great to see like the evolution of Peter Dinklage's character, because he's definitely the big show stealer on the show, because even though he's kind of a despicable and immoral character, you can't help but like him and stuff, because he still kind of has his own code of honor. He always has this running gag where he always pays his debts no matter what and stuff. So it's kind of cool to see this guy who's a dwarf in an era when dwarfs were not looked upon too fondly still kind of have a lot of power with them. Like, he's still a guy who always stands up for himself and kind of still kind of manages to get some respect and stuff. So he's such a fascinating character. So yeah, I'm definitely going to continue watching this, because I know I've heard recently that the series is starting to go off the rails, but for the past several years, it's kind of maintained its fan base and remained popular. So I'm really anxious to see where it's going to go.
Oh, it's totally going to stay popular all the way to the end. For all my bitching about the most recent episode and the fact that people are saying like, oh, it's, you know, it's going down in quality a bit, but it's going to stay the most popular show ever right until its final episode, I predict. But it is so cool hearing you talk about these events that are so early on in the show's history, because it has come so far since then. Like, you're talking about Brandon Stark falling out of the tower. The kid who plays him, what was his name? I can't remember his name. But he grows up before your eyes on the show. Like, you see him become a young man as the show progresses. And it really is amazing to see these actors who really are these like little kids, like Maisie Williams, who plays Arya Stark. She's still on the show and she is like a young woman now. And it's wild to watch her just grow up as the show progresses. So, I mean, you're in for an interesting time, even on that front, just watching the seasons in a more accelerated way and just watching these kids age before your eyes. That's really something. But, I'm just so excited for you to hit all of these plot points, all the big points of the series as you go forward.
And I really like seeing these, like, respected British actors that I hadn't seen in years pop up on the show, like Julian Glover from like Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Like, I used to see him all the time during the 80s and 90s, and I had no idea he was still acting, and here he is with like this big white beard popping up for a pivotal role on the show. I thought that was pretty cool.
Oh, and what's her name? Help me out, TK. Olenna Tyrell.
Oh, Diana Riggs.
Diana Riggs.
Oh, cool.
Yeah,
awesome.
She pops up and plays one of the best characters in the whole series. So
nice.
Yeah.
Jonathan Pryce is on it.
That's right.
And who's one of the maesters in the latest season that's really good?
Oh, it's Jim Broadbent is on the show.
Yeah, I love Jim. I love him so much. When he popped up, I was so excited.
Well, even like Charles Dance, who kind of faded into obscurity for a while, but after being in Game of Thrones, I now see him everywhere.
Oh, yeah, and he is so good. He's just so cutthroat on that show. So who are some of your favorite and least favorite characters? Because, of course, Game of Thrones is notorious for having this huge cast.
Well, I definitely like Peter Dinklage's character. What's his name again? I'm trying to
Tyrion.
Remember. Tyrion, yes. He's definitely the highlight of the show. I think it's kind of genius that they have like a dwarf character be kind of like the biggest badass on the show, and I can see why Peter Dinklage has become like the most popular actor to emerge from the show. So yeah, he's definitely my favorite, and I like Ned. by Sean Bean, like, because he's kind of the moral center of the show, but I don't have high hopes from him. Like, Sean Bean's in it, so I don't know if his character, how long he's going to last. Of course, the minute I saw he was, like, the lead actor on the show, I was kind of like, oh, I don't see much for him. I wonder how long he's going to last on the show.
Interesting, very interesting. And what about your least favorite characters? Are there any characters that you dislike or hate? Because, you know, you mentioned Joffrey being one of the most hated characters in TV history. Another big part of the Game of Thrones pop culture phenomenon is hating on the bat. You know, you boo for your most hated characters and cheer for the ones you're rooting for.
I really hated Daenerys's brother. He was so whiny, but he got the most awesome death scene when Khal Drogo poured the hot, like, molten stuff over his head and just caused,
oh, man,
like, his entire head to
melt. Golden Crown moment.
Yeah, that was just amazing. That was one of the best death scenes I've seen on television. And I'm like, the character I love to hate is Littlefinger, because Aidan Gillen I mostly just know from The Wire, seeing him play like an American Baltimore mayor, but I know this is his most prominent role, so I'm anxious to see more of his character, because he was only introduced on like episode 3 or 4.
Okay, my favorite TK, character. Yeah, jump in, because it's TK's favorite character.
I love Littlefinger. He just gets more and more conniving as the series goes on, and it's oh man. I don't know what else to say, because I don't want to spoil a whole lot, because I know a lot of it's been spoiled just generally, but like, I kind of want Robin to experience it. I really do. Actually, I'm curious, Robin, are you going to keep watching?
Oh yeah, definitely. Like, awesome. Yeah, because it is compelling enough for me to go all the way through. And I know, like, you've had complaints about it, but I've never seen anybody really hit the point, like, say, The Walking Dead, where they just get so fed up by the stupidity that they can no longer watch it. Because from what I hear, Game of Thrones, even when it's flawed, that it's still watching and worth watching and sticking through.
Yeah, I mean, I'm on board till the bitter end, and I can't say the same for The Walking Dead, that's for sure. We're talking, you know, TK was talking about he doesn't want to spoil it for you, and neither do I, because, boy, there are just so many great moments on the show. But that's a whole other thing about Game of Thrones, is spoiler culture. I feel like Game of Thrones itself has changed the way we talk about spoilers, because it's so popular, but the show has such big, wild moments that it's got this whole thing about, like, spoiler clampdown. So here are two questions related to that. First is, how much was spoiled for you? Has a lot been spoiled?
Well, what's funny is I've heard you guys, like, talk about it nonstop, like, the past, like, couple years, and you've probably spoiled stuff on podcasts, but I don't remember any of it, because you would talk about these characters, and I had no idea, like, who anybody was, and their names meant nothing to me, so there's really nothing I remember, so it's like, I really have no idea what's going to happen. Like, I recognize some of these names, but if I've heard what happens to them, I can't remember it, so there really isn't anything that I'm expecting.
That is amazing. And so this is me saying to all you listeners out there, eat it, spoiler culture. Here we have a case where Robin has been exposed to constant Game of Thrones spoilers for the entire duration of the series. We have talked about everything that has gone on in the show since the very beginning, right here with Robin, and he still has not had it spoiled for him. So that's how much spoiler culture is pointless. You can't.
It's true.
It's dumb.
I mean, if I was already watching the show, then sure, it would be a big deal. But it's like, if I've never watched an episode of the show, it means nothing to me when people talk about the plot points. So it's like, that's, spoilers only matter if you're a regular watcher of the show. But otherwise, just talk away about it.
Aha, and I thumb my nose at spoiler culture again. That's great. And that makes me really happy too, that you still haven't had it spoiled even by us. So all of these big revelations are going to be surprises. I really hope you get a chance to finish the first season before we record our final episode next week, so I can hear your thoughts on the events of those last few episodes. And here's the next question. Got any predictions? Another big part of the fun with Game of Thrones is predicting what's going to happen.
Well, I said Ned Stark is going to die, because he's played by Sean Bean, of course. But the only spoiler I know is that Sansa and Arya are still going to be alive by the most recent season, so I know they're not going to die. But yeah, it's hard for me to know. I just have a feeling that I think I remember hearing that Jack Leeson eventually left the show, so I have a feeling that Joffrey is either going to be killed or written off the show at some point, because I think I heard somewhere that he retired from acting because he had people who literally hated him because they hated the character so much. So
unfortunate.
Which I find quite amusing. But otherwise, no, I can't really predict what's going to happen, because that's kind of the whole gimmick of the show, is people's allegiances change so much that you can't really know what anyone's going to do.
That is so terrific. I'm so excited, Robin. Like, even though we won't be recording this podcast, I am still going to be checking in with you to get your thoughts on Game of Thrones so I can kind of relive discovering the show for the first time vicariously through your experience. That's just so great.
It's kind of funny, though, seeing Emilia Clark in this, because my only exposure for her is playing Sarah Connor. So every time I see her, I think of all those stupid scenes in Terminator Genesis where she kept calling the Terminator Pops. So it's actually good to see her actually give a good performance.
That's true. It is pretty cool to see the actors on the show in these parts and then like watch them pop up in movies where you hadn't really noticed them. Not that long ago, I ran one of my bad movie marathons, and we were watching bad video game movies, and I played the trailer for the first Tomb Raider movie with Angelina Jolie, and the villain is the guy who plays Jorah Mormont on Game of Thrones. I had no idea who that guy was, but it was wild seeing him be like, oh my god, it's Jorah Mormont. So...
Oh, and what also excited me is seeing Lurch from Hot Fuzz, Rory McCann. I kept expecting him to go, yarb!
Oh, so man, the it's Hound. Really oh, my God. Only one of the best characters in the whole series.
It's really funny because Maisie Williams had the same thing. She could not remember where she'd seen him before when they started acting, and then finally he put on like a sideways hat and said, yarp.
Yes.
Oh, well, that's terrific. So, hey, on the topic of HBO, we can segue into The Sopranos. And so I have not seen the whole first season, I regret. I've seen 6 episodes of the first season, like halfway through. And I will say this, it is definitely an entertaining show, and it is just a show-stopping performance by James Gandolfini. He is terrific as Tony Soprano. I love a lot of the supporting cast as well. The late John Hurd just turned up as that unhinged detective character, and it was kind of like bittersweet seeing him and James Gandolfini acting alongside each other, because they're both deceased now. And related to that is the fact that this show is a hell of a time capsule. You know, the Twin Towers are in the opening credits, and the main actor is now gone. It's really something, and I'm very curious to see that aspect of it going forward and watching like the technology evolve. I'm sure the cell phones that everybody uses by the end of the series are very different than the flip phones they're using in the first season.
Well, one thing I wanted to mention, I don't know if you've gotten this far, but there's actually a scene where they're watching bootleg DVDs of The Godfather because it hadn't been initially released on DVD that time.
Yeah, they were.
Oh, you saw that?
Yeah, they talk about like DVD players as this new technology. Like there's a scene where like Tony beats up a guy and takes a DVD player from him. And I'm like, that's worthless now. DVD players, people throw them away. It is a really interesting little time capsule in that respect.
They say, hey, Paramount, get off your ass and release the real thing on DVD already.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. That is really neat to sort of look back in time, and I do remember the time when this was on, and it's kind of crazy to think just how long that's been now. Makes me feel really old. I love the conceit of a mob boss talking to his therapist. I think that is a really great storytelling device, and that is some of the most compelling stuff for me. You know, getting just that one-on-one insight into the mind of Tony Soprano. That, for me, thus far, has been the real meat of the show. Because I gotta say, guys, while I am interested and there are these things that I like, I don't find myself itching to know what happens next. I have yet to see an episode that ended and made me go, like, oh, what's going to happen next? It made me rush to put on the next one. The way even like the first episode of Game of Thrones, like you said, Robin, it ends on such a big cliffhanger that you immediately want to know what's going to happen next. And I feel like The Sopranos must be a much slower burn because I haven't gotten that yet. And part of the reason I feel like I'm not being hooked in just yet is that it seems like the show thus far is more about the struggle to balance the life of a gangster with the life of a family man. It seems like that conflict is really the big antagonistic force on the show thus far. You know, Tony's wife suspects that he's cheating on her, and he is, but she hasn't actually caught him yet. And she's now like teasing him about the priest staying over, and oh, did they have an affair, didn't they? And like that tension is starting to boil over. The tension between his wife and his daughter is coming to a head, and like his son's getting into fights at school. All of these things are, you know, seem to be making it more of a character piece than a gangster drama, even necessarily like something like The Godfather. So I'm really curious. This is much like you, Robin. Like, I'm going to finish the first season, and I'll probably give the second season a good shot. And I can see why people would find this type of storytelling compelling, especially when it hadn't quite been done in a serialized form by HBO. Like, The Sopranos really laid the groundwork for what HBO is now with things like Game of Thrones and then like The Wire as well and things like that. And so like I can see why this was groundbreaking TV at the time, but I gotta ask you guys, like, does it pick up or is it this sort of slow burn thing all the way through?
It is kind of, it does move at a deliberate pace, and there's going to be, as time goes on, more focus on like the inner workings of the mob and like the conflicts where Tony's life actually becomes in danger. But I do know that like the first like several episodes did want to focus more on his personal life and his balancing his job with his family and him like and his issues with his mother. But as the series goes on, like more and more stuff unravels with Tony so that his life will like gradually fall apart in places. It's kind of like Breaking Bad where it's like a lot of his sins come back to haunt him as time goes on.
Okay. See, that is definitely interesting to me. Thus far, I found the first episode to actually be the most interesting because it was all framed within a conversation with his therapist. And like we sort of go back in his recent past and, you know, the whole thing with the ducks and what do the ducks mean. I found that stuff really interesting. And as the amount of him talking to his therapist has sort of diminished as the episodes have gone on, I've been craving more of that. I find that to be much more interesting than a lot of like, oh, what, you know, what college is his daughter going to go to? I find, you know what I mean?
You've seen the college episode, right?
Yes.
Well, that episode, like, I think the big impact of that episode occurred when it originally aired in 1999 because it was kind of considered way ahead of its time because it ends with Tony trying to balance the act of, like, taking his daughter to college while finding out this guy in witness protection and then going to murder him. And I heard from, like, David Chase, the creator of the series, that he had so many fights with HBO about that episode saying that, no, Tony's the main character. He can't kill somebody. Then people won't like him. And he always said, well, that's kind of the point of the show is that he's not a good guy. He does terrible things. So the show will be kind of pointless if we don't actually see him killing somebody. And that was kind of considered really shocking at the time that, like, your main character on a TV series would commit like a cold-blooded murder. And that was kind of when that episode like aired originally, like there was like a huge buzz surrounding it because like television at the time had not really shown anything like that. I'm sure if you watch the episode today, it doesn't seem like a big deal because we've seen so many TV series like this and Breaking Bad where the hero or the main character commits murder. But during that time period, it was a pretty big deal.
You know what? That's really interesting because that answers the question that I've been asking you guys. I guess pop culture kind of spoiled this a little bit for me.
It's true, yes.
Because, yeah, I didn't think twice about that because I had seen something like Breaking Bad. I've seen this type of anti-hero on a TV show before who will murder somebody and yet remain a sympathetic character. This has been done, and I've seen it multiple times, even, you know, Breaking Bad, Boardwalk Empire. So, yeah, I you know, maybe pop culture and the influence of The Sopranos has diminished the impact of The Sopranos a little bit. I don't know, TK, do you have any thoughts in that regard?
Sorry, run that by me again. You guys fuzzed out for a sec.
Has pop culture spoiled this for me?
You know what? Not really. When I watched it in its entirety, I think 2 years ago. And like a whole bunch of stuff like really surprised me. Like a lot of character actions, a lot of character deaths. The finale was a little spoiled for me because it was all over everywhere whenever it first aired. But no, I wasn't really spoiled by anything in this. Each episode was kind of new.
Fascinating. I don't know. Do you guys have any questions about the show for me? All I can sort of think of is the jumble of episodes that I watched recently.
Well, since we mentioned the ending, do you remember? Like, you've probably heard it so many times within the last decade or so, it's kind of become a meme, but do you remember what the ending of this series is?
Yeah, I remember. But again, you know, I'm sort of lacking context. I know that Tony Soprano is in a restaurant, and somebody significant to him enters the restaurant, and he turns and, like, looks over at them, and then it just cuts to black. And it's so abrupt and leaves so much hanging that apparently people called, like, their cable companies thinking that the episode had ended prematurely. Am I right?
Yes, pretty much, yes. That was caused a huge furor at the time. Like, watching it live, you can see how people could be outraged by it. But as you watch it again, like when I watched the last season a second time, there were some hints dropped throughout the course of the series, which kind of built up to that moment. So it's like the more you think about it, the more you realize what probably happened at that moment. But it'll be interesting to see if you notice any of those things as you go along, so that when the ending finally hits, it might make sense to you.
Yeah, honestly, finding, like, maybe one of the most interesting things about watching the whole series for me is going to be leading up to the finale, so that I finally have the context of someone who has seen, like, this rich tapestry being spun before me, and like this long, intricate, influential, famous TV series, only to have it end in a very abrupt way. Like, maybe finally having that experience that so many people have talked about, that could be the big revelation of The Sopranos for me.
So what are your favorite and least favorite characters thus far?
I mean, favorite has got to be Tony Soprano. He's such at the center of it all, and I think it's a combination of the fact that the show is so focused on him, but also that he's given just the most interesting things to do. Like, he just stands out above everyone else. I find his family, like, they're all well-written characters, but they alternate between being irritating and being generic. Like, oh, what a surprise, his son gets into fights at school. It's really, you know, nothing too special. And I like the supporting cast of mobsters. I haven't really, like, gotten to know them very well. I've seen them all go out on these smaller missions, but I haven't actually, I don't even know. I know some of the names, but I can't really apply them very well, just because it's just so many Italian guys. Like, there's the young upstart guy who really wants to be a made man, and he's overly ambitious. But so, you know, he's well written, he's well acted, but it's just kind of like a gangster trope for me at this point. I mean, I guess there's Big Pussy. He's got some personality and a memorable name. I like him quite a bit. Was it Vincent Pastore plays him?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those characters are going to get their own story arc and get a lot more depth as the series goes along.
That's great. It is cool seeing Tony just like go about the business. Like, it is just a job for him, and you know, all of these things are just aspects of the job. That side of the show is pretty cool. And, you know, Tony has, I want to say it's like in episode 2, it might even be in episode 1, But he has a few speeches early on talking about just gangsters as a whole. And like we've said, you know, they're constantly referencing the Godfather, and they talk about how, you know, retired mobsters are selling their stories for movie and TV rights. And I'm sure there must be some aspect of that to this, right? I'm sure actual criminals weighed in on the content of The Sopranos.
Oh, yes, probably. Probably unofficially. But I know that they apparently did their homework so that if real mob guys, people with knowledge of this, watched it and thought it was very authentic.
I mean, that's pretty cool. But one thing I liked is Tony talking about how he talks about how the golden age of the mafia is over. You know, the golden age of organized crime is in the past now, and it's too easy to track them down, and the court sentences are so huge, and everybody snitches on everybody now. And he talks about how getting into narcotics was the real downfall of the mafia, bringing drugs into it. And, like, hearing stuff like that was really interesting, especially when I was doing my sort of refresher on the Godfather trilogy, how you see the moment where they're talking about, like, we need to get into narcotics. This is the next phase of organized crime. And I also remember back on Boardwalk Empire when heroin becomes an aspect of organized crime. So it's interesting to sort of look through all those different eras of organized crime and the mafia and then hear Tony say, you know, I feel like I'm coming in at the end of this legacy. I feel like all the good stuff is gone. Now I'm just left to pick up the pieces. That stuff is really interesting. You know, it heavy hangs the crown of the king of crime.
Yeah, I kind of find that interesting that they're not portrayed as overly rich. Like, Tony has a nice house, but they're more kind of middle-class guys. Like, they don't live in large mansions, and they mostly, like, hang out in these kind of rundown-looking shops. Like, there's nothing glamorous, like, portrayed in The Godfather, like, 50 years before that.
But they are constantly talking about The Godfather, and it's obvious that they have that reverence for it. So, yeah, like, aspects like that are really interesting. And I'll give it this season. I'm going to try and stick with it because it's just so popular. Like, obviously there must be something to this. You guys both really enjoyed it. So I feel like I owe it to myself to give it the old college try and really stick with it. But like I said, you know, I feel like this beginning, it's starting really slow. Maybe it's going to ramp into it more, but right now I find myself going, like, I'll watch an episode and I'll be like, and that, you know, I'm good for now. Maybe tomorrow night I'll watch another one. But I have yet to watch an episode and then go, like, I need to know how that ends. I need to see the next one right away.
At the very least, you should make it to the Pine Barrens episode. I think it's in the middle of season three. It's one where, like, Christopher and Polly are chasing this guy through the Pine Barren woods in New Jersey in the middle of winter. And I always call that one of the best episodes of television ever produced, in that even if you never watched The Sopranos before and you just watch that episode, it's such a great standalone story that it would be amazing to watch on its own. It's so brilliantly put together.
Well, there it is. There is my goal. I will watch until that episode. And if I'm not hooked by the end of that, I'll probably drop the show. But I'm going to give it until then at least. So I think that brings us to the end of our discussion of, you know, these bucket list items that we had to cross off of our viewing lists. And man, this has been great. Like, I'm coming away from this really happy. I can't wait to hear from you, Robin, about, you know, re-experiencing these things in Game of Thrones. And TK, you finally saw the Godfather trilogy and you really enjoyed them. That is just so great as well. It's awesome to finally cross these ones off. And I thought a fun way to wrap this up is for us to sort of start our own new bucket lists by asking, are there any other egregious omissions from your, like, viewing history? Are there things that, you know, if you confessed, I haven't seen this, people are going to go, like, whoa! Can you think of any?
I'm trying to think here. Like, there aren't any major movies and stuff. It was kind of funny when I was thinking about movies. There are some where they're not great movies, but they're ones that I always hear people say as their childhood favorites. But it's kind of like I was too old when they originally came out, so I never bothered to watch it. But kind of funny, but the first movie I think of is Hocus Pocus, where it's like every Halloween people tell me how they love that movie growing up, but to this
You've never seen Hocus Pocus?
No, don't fall for it. It's not good.
Yeah. But did you like that one growing up? Was that one of your favorites, or did you not even like it at the time?
Well, you know what? I feel like I was maybe a year or two too old when it came out. I was like too cool for it in what, like grade four or whatever. But my little sister loved it. So I did see it in theaters and it is a pretty good time, but I rewatched it recently for Halloween. And no, this is just a really, this is a really hammy movie. I have to say, you know, the trio of witches, the Sanderson sisters, they look great and they're really well cast, but the movie itself is pretty dumb. But TK, it sounds like this is like a nostalgic favorite of yours.
Yeah, it's true. I'm kind of shocked, Robin. It's a fun movie, but like you're right, Gil. There are some points of it. It's a little flat, but it's yeah.
I'd be interested to hear your thoughts, Robin. But something tells me that if you didn't see this when you were a kid, it's not going to hold up at all.
Well, it's kind of funny because I think the Nostalgia Critic recently or last year did an episode where he said, is this really like a Halloween classic? Like he just devoted it saying that people every year say it's one of their favorite Halloween movies, but it's objectively terrible. So it's just kind of one of those bizarre ones that have like gotten a cult following.
I mean, it's got the Necronomicon in it. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, okay. There you go. Yeah,
fair enough. TK, the list of things you haven't seen is long and shameful.
It is still long and shameful. Like, I haven't seen Gone with the Wind.
What? Oh, that's such a you movie, too.
Really?
Surprising thing, every time I learn of a classic film that you haven't seen, the most surprising thing is there are always movies that I know you're going to love. Like, you're going to friggin' love Rhett Butler. What the hell?
Oh, yeah, no, I'm sure I will. I just haven't seen. I'm going through the AFI list right now, and I'm just trying to see if there's anything big that I haven't caught. I've never seen Easy Rider.
What?
Yeah, I do. No, I know. And hang on a second.
It's so overrated, though. It's so dated, Easy Rider. Yeah.
Okay, but it has such a good Jack Nicholson performance in it, and I think you're going to love it for that alone.
Oh, I'm sure I will. And what's the other? Oh, I've never seen The French Connection either.
Oh, that's a pretty interesting one there.
Yeah. And hang on a second. Like I've seen 8 out of the top 10, so because I haven't seen On the Waterfront either.
Ah, it could have been a contender. You know, that really is a classic.
Yeah, do a whole Marlon Brando sweep. But yeah, like there's some big stuff. Like I'm sure I'll try to watch. Like Gone with the Wind is another big long one, eh? Like 3.5 hours or something.
Yeah,
like,
it's a pretty long one.
I just sat through 3 3.5 hour movies. I can do Gone with the Wind. It's no problem at all. And I'm trying to think, like there's not a, I can't think of like a big TV show or something I never watched. Oh, I never watched a lot of Friends. I think I've seen like one episode,
oh,
one or two
don't
episodes.
Don't bother, you know. I've never liked Friends.
But like culturally, you know, there's a lot.
Yeah, there are a lot of TV shows like that where I've seen a few episodes here and there, but not enough to like make myself look like someone who really knows. Like Friends, I have seen a few episodes. Something like Doctor Who, like I've seen a few episodes here or there, but I'm not fanatically obsessed with it like some people are, so I couldn't really talk about it at all. So, yeah, I find that with a lot of TV shows I watch where I sometimes won't see them when they're at their most popular, but then just eventually watch them like years after the fact and then kind of binge them, kind of like I'm doing now with Game of Thrones.
Here's my TV confession is I haven't seen all of Twin Peaks.
I've never seen Twin Peaks.
I've seen a bit of Twin Peaks and I've tried so many times to get into it and I have such a hard time. You know, maybe I'm just never in the right mood, but it just never grabs me and it's such a cultural phenomenon that I always feel like I'm missing out by not having seen all of it and then the new season too.
What's another one I haven't seen that I keep meaning to is that after watching the original 12 Men.
12 Angry Men?
Yeah, 12 Angry Men. Who's the lead in it? That's really awful.
Fonda.
Yeah, okay. I have never seen him in anything. And so like I feel like I should go back and like watch The Grapes of Wrath and like watch him because like I was super into his performance in that. So I'd be interested in seeing what else he's done.
All his westerns, man.
That's Once true. Upon a Time in the West.
Yeah. Oh my God. What an incredible Western that one is. Here are some omissions from my list. Or sorry, Robin, was there something else you wanted to say?
Yes, I remember I mentioned this on a earlier episode, and I think TK freaked out. I don't think I've ever seen an entire episode of Star Trek The Next Generation.
Whoa,
that breaks my heart. It really does.
That is very surprising. Have you seen any of this, like the original Star Trek series?
Maybe an episode here or there, but I couldn't really tell you any specific episodes or anything.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Oh, and I've never watched Buffy. I've never watched an episode of Buffy.
Wow.
Ever.
Yeah, you know, I.
Okay, that show's aged hard.
It's pretty dated. It is pretty dated, I have to say.
The movie's a lot of fun, though. I love the movie.
CGI does not look good. Some glaring omissions from my list. To write these down, I went through the IMDb top 250 movies and the AFI top 100 movies of all time. And I've seen most of them. And a lot of the ones that I haven't seen, I didn't actually think of as movies where, like, if I said, oh, I haven't seen this, you guys would be like, oh my God. Like, a lot of the ones that I hadn't seen, especially on the IMDb top 250, are just like, some of them were movies I'd never even heard of. They're not movies that I think are talked about a lot. Like, if I say I haven't seen The Last Picture Show, I don't think you guys are going to be like, what? Like, not that surprising. But here are four movies that might surprise you that I haven't seen. I haven't seen To Kill a Mockingbird. I've read it. Haven't seen it.
Oh, wow. I thought it would have been screened for you.
No, you know, I never watched it. It's
wow.
Just, yeah. A Streetcar Named Desire. Haven't seen it.
Oh, wow.
Talking about Brando. Stella. Nope. Haven't seen that one. Platoon is one that I have not seen.
Oh, that surprises me.
Yeah. And then finally, this one is maybe the most surprising, but I've never seen Tootsie.
Oh, no!
Jesus.
There we go.
Wow.
I knew I could get one big reaction out of you guys. Yeah, never seen Tootsie.
Man, now I'm going through the top 100 IMDb ones. I haven't seen The Seventh Samurai.
Shocking. Did you see The Magnificent Seven?
Yes, I did.
You kind of, wait, the McQueen one, though, right?
Yeah.
Then you've kind of seen The Seven Samurai.
Yeah, I know. And I'm just trying to think. Like, there's a lot of these. I've seen a lot of them. I don't think I've seen Double Indemnity, like, as my grand.
Oh, that is a terrific movie, man.
You would love that one.
Yeah, that is such a, that is a TK movie for sure.
Yeah. No, I've seen a lot of these. All right.
But, like, yeah, I've never seen The Lives of Others. See? That's what...
Which is good, but it's not a must-see movie.
Yeah, I think that... And that's what a lot of these... Like, number 81 on the IMDb Top 250 is called Like Stars on Earth. It's a 2007 movie. Have you guys even heard of that one?
Nope.
Exactly.
Nope.
So there you go, you know, like... There are a lot of ones like that from these top lists, but I guess Tootsie is the one that got the biggest reaction. And with that, fellas, it's time to play The Ticket Price is Right, the box office prediction game where we try to predict the opening weekend box office grosses of movies being released this week, and we also look back on last week's predictions. And guys, guess what? This is the last time we will be predicting movies in The Ticket Price is Right. And so first, let's review our predictions from last episode. We were predicting the opening totals for two movies. First was The Hitman's Bodyguard, the Ryan Reynolds, Samuel L. Jackson buddy action comedy. And TK, you won. You said it would make $20 million. It made $21 million. Surprising a lot of people. I don't think anybody thought it would do that well.
It's Ryan Reynolds and Samuel L. Jackson. Of course it's going to draw people.
And then Logan Lucky, which Robin saw and quite enjoyed. Sadly, it did not do super well. It only made $7.6 million, which was closest to my bid of $10 million. And that means that TK is still in the lead with 13. I have 11 points, and Robin is at 7. And we are closing off by predicting opening totals for three movies. So if I get all three, I might actually win by a point.
But... we have to find six movies so I can have a chance to win.
But The bad news is that the three movies coming out this week, the three big releases, I mean, who knows what's going to happen with these? We are full on in the like dumping ground of late August because, man, I don't think any of these stand a chance of getting actually number one at the box office. So first up is this movie called All Saints. Have you guys even heard of this?
Don't think so. No.
Nope.
So All Saints is it doesn't even star anybody of note. It's let me read the plot summary for you guys because I couldn't find its budget. All Saints is based on the inspiring true story of salesman turned pastor Michael Spurlock, the tiny church he was ordered to shut down, and a group of refugees from Southeast Asia. Together, they risked everything to plant seeds for a future that might save them all. It's like a feel-good religious movie, I guess?
Yeah, sometimes these happen where they're produced by religious organizations, and then they actually do pretty decently at the box office with their core audience, like in some parts of the U.S., even though they never really get a wide release.
Well, I couldn't tell you how much the budget is, and Robin, you get to predict first. How much will All Saints make in its opening weekend?
Even though I've never heard of it, I'm going to still go with $7 million because usually in like the Bible Belt, these movies make a lot of money, even though they don't get a wide release. So surprisingly, it's probably going to make some money.
TK, what do you think?
I'll go a little higher. I'll go 10.
$10 million for TK. And I'm going low because I've never heard of this. It doesn't even have a Wikipedia page. Usually I go to the Wikipedia page to find out a film's budget. This one doesn't have one. So I'm going to say $2 million. I think it's, you know, it's still going to draw a small crowd, but I don't think it's going to do well at all. Next up is a movie called Birth of the Dragon, which is based on a true story of Bruce Lee meeting a very famous martial artist. And it stars Philip Ng, who is like an up-and-coming martial arts star, who Robin and I saw in 2014 at the Fantasia Film Festival in Montreal in the movie Once Upon a Time in Shanghai. And I remember at the time he was being hyped as like this new sort of Bruce Lee type action hero because he does bear a resemblance to Bruce Lee. Again, couldn't find the budget for this one, so... Robin, Birth of the Dragon. How much will it make?
It's barely gotten any press at all, and I don't think it even has any reviews on Rotten Tomatoes, so I'm going to go low. I'll go $3 million.
$3 million. TK, what do you think?
I'll go $5 million.
$5 million. That was actually going to be my guess, so instead I'm going to swing way low and just say I'll go $2 million again. I'll go really low there. And then finally, I really wanted to have three movies here so that there was the possibility that the tide could turn and that it wouldn't wind up with just like a normal tie, even though it may yet. So Ballerina is an animated movie being released this week. Now, it has a budget of $30 million, and we have to keep in mind as we predict our opening totals for this one that we're predicting the opening totals for when it opens this weekend, but it actually came out in the UK last December. So it's already made some money overseas. I don't know if that's going to affect its box office, but it's sort of an interesting case where the movie has already been released for quite some time elsewhere. So with a budget of $30 million and being the only animated film to be released in weeks now, I think, Robin, how well do you think Ballerina will do?
I haven't heard too much about this at all, so I'm going to go maybe $13 million.
$13 million. TK?
I'll go $15 million.
$15 million, and I'll go low again with $10 million. And there they are, our final predictions to determine the winner of the final season of The Ticket Price is Right. It's kind of exciting. Now, you guys may not know this, but The Ticket Price is Right was inspired by a podcast that I listened to many years ago that has been off the air for a long time, like years now. It was called the Rope of Silicon podcast with Brad Brevet and Laramie Legel, two film critics who wrote all over the place online. And I believe you can still read their writings everywhere. And what the Rope of Silicon podcast would do is they had a section that was just games where they would play three games called Over Under, Buy or Sell, and Playing the Percentages. And they would just take, it wasn't for like points. They didn't keep track of the points the way we've been keeping track of it. This was just for fun. It was just a format for their listeners to ask them questions. And so in honor of Rope of Silicon and in honor of winding down the podcast, I'm going to play these three games with you. I have two examples for each of these three games, and you'll see very quickly, it's just a matter of me posing you a question and you have to answer in relation to the title of the game. So for example, Over Under will be the first game that we play. And Over Under is, I'm going to like make a statement involving a number, and you have to give me your opinion on whether the correct answer is over that number or under that number. And so, for example, this first one, I'm posing to you, TK. Over under, Robin buys a snack when he goes to the movies 50% of the time, one out of every two visits. Over or under?
Over.
Over. I'm gonna say under. I think it's a bit more rare than that. Robin, what is the answer?
Under, I'd say. Oftentimes I'll get coffee, and I don't know if I'd count that as a snack. So if we're not counting, if we're counting food, then it's definitely under.
And how often do you get coffee?
Almost every time, actually.
Ah, interesting, interesting. So it's kind of like a balancing act. If we count coffee as Robin getting a snack, then it's over. But if we don't, then it's under. And then here's the one for you, Robin. Three is the number of cookies that TK eats on any given week. Over, under?
I'd say over.
I'm going to say under, but I'm just to be contrary, because it's probably over. TK?
I have the metabolism of a hummingbird. I eat cookies a lot, at least.
Have you eaten three cookies today?
Since we started recording this.
No.
He's eaten five cookies.
Hang on.
Since the start of this episode.
I haven't had any today, but I think I had like eight yesterday.
Oh my God. So definitely over.
Yeah.
All right. So next game is buy or sell. And it really is. Do you buy the statement or sell? Do you disagree? Buy or sell, Matt Reeves will drop out of directing Batman.
I'll buy that.
Yeah, you think he's going to drop out?
Possibly, yes.
TK, buy or sell? Matt Reeves will drop out of directing Batman.
I'll buy that.
Yeah, I'm buying it too. It's already undergone a director change with Affleck no longer directing. And even Justice League had sort of like a director swap out because Zack Snyder had to leave for, you know, family reasons, and Joss Whedon took over post-production and reshoots of Justice League. So it doesn't seem like there's much stability in these DC movies, so I will also buy that Matt Reeves will drop out of directing Batman. Buy or sell, guys, in King Kong versus Godzilla, Godzilla will win.
I'm going to go with sell. I think it's probably going to be like Freddy versus Jason, where it's going to have some tie somehow to like not to satisfy both the owners of both franchises.
You think so? Because there was a recent article where they said, the director said, it's going to have a definitive ending. But even that is suspect because, of course, they usually do those dumb tie endings, even if they claim to have definitive ones. Does that change your answer, though?
No, I'm going to go with sell.
Sell. And TK, buy or sell? Godzilla will win in King Kong versus Godzilla.
No, I don't buy it.
Selling it?
Yeah, I think Kong's going to win.
Oh, you know what? I'll buy it. I think Godzilla will probably win. He's a big dinosaur versus a monkey. If they do indeed have a definitive ending, as the director claims, it's going to be Godzilla. And then finally, percents. percentages. We be playing the percentages is how the theme song for this game used to go on Rope of Silicon. And this one's really simple, is I just ask you for the percent chance of something. So percent chance of Avatar 2 being delayed until a 2021 release.
I'm going to go with 100%. I really don't think this movie's going to happen at all, because it's like Avatar is just one of those huge blockbusters that everyone has forgotten about after a couple years. Like, there's going to be no demand for this, like, by 2021. I think it's going to be shelved.
It's currently slated for a 2020 release. TK, percent chance of Avatar 2 being delayed until 2021?
75. We'll see how that goes.
I'm going to go a little higher, and I'm going to say 85%. I think there's a really good chance. I think it's going to be released, but I do think it's going to be delayed by, like, a year. Just because it's, you know, not only has it been so long, but it's going to be so special effects heavy that it's inevitably going to be pushed yet again. And it's one of those things where it's like, after this amount of time, like, we're only 2 years away from it having been a decade since Avatar came out. After all this time, it's like, what's a few more years? Nobody's going to care.
Well, I'm sure Sam Worthington's going to be way too busy for the next couple of years.
I hope they can get him back.
Yeah.
And now here's the last one for percentages. Percent chance of a fourth season of Hannibal. There's been talk, but there's always talk, right?
I'll go with 50%, because, I mean, there's going to be a demand for it, but it's just a matter of if the networks go for it, and there's still things you could go. Like, they had kind of an ambiguous cliffhanger ending, literally, so they could bring it back if need be, so I'm going to go 50-50.
And TK, what's your percent on Hannibal Season 4?
Man, I have to do the same. I know there's been talk, and I'm interested, so, well, I won't hedge my bets, but think about it.
I'm going way low. I say 25%. I just don't think it's going to happen at this point. Mads Mikkelsen has gone on to become too big of a star. Like, he was in Doctor Strange and Rogue One within a year of each other. So I think he's too big of a star to come back. And I don't know, man. Brian Fuller, he just never has that kind of luck, does he? It just never works out. Sadly, I don't think it's going to happen. And part of me doesn't even want it to happen, because while the demand is there for sure, they concluded that story. You know, the ending was good enough for me. But who knows? The talk will continue, I'm sure. And now it's time for the dumb joke of the week. So, an underage weasel walks into a bar, and the bartender says, "You're too young to have a beer." The weasel says, "Oh, I don't like alcohol anyway. Do you have anything non-alcoholic?" "Well," goes the bartender, "we have coffee, soda, orange juice, water." "Pop," goes the weasel.
Oh,
get out.
Yeah. No. Well, look us up at the back row, the-back-row.com, where you can find links to all of our various projects. You can find our back episodes of this podcast. You can find my video editing portfolio at mcgillfoot.com. And of course, Robin's massively popular true crime podcast, The Trail Went Cold, at trailwentcold.com. And be sure to like it on Facebook. Join the Facebook discussion group. There's going to be so much more Trail Went Cold content coming out after this podcast shuts down, because I'll be able to devote even more time to it. It's going to be like merchandise and stuff, guys. It's going to be really exciting. And you can find all that stuff back where it began at the-back-row.com. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next week.